Committee on Education and General Government. Please turn off all cell phones, PDAs, electronic devices. Otherwise, we make you make a contribution to the Common School Fund. And if you're here to sign up and testify, it's over there on the left. It's cold in this room, but I can't fix that. It will soon heat up, I'm sure. All right, so the first bill up, we're going to open a public hearing on the House Bill 2848.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2848 modifies certain high school diploma requirements from years to credits, requires the award of a modified diploma to a student who meets the State Board of Education requirements but does not satisfy the regular diploma requirements, requires the award of an alternative certificate to a student who meets requirements established by a school district board or public charter school board, but again, for a student who does not meet the regular diploma requirements. It permits the recipient of a modified diploma or the alternative certificate to participate in graduation ceremonies with their class. It requires the school district or public charter school to make modified or alternative diplomas first available during the 2008-2009 school year. It requires the district to give a child with disabilities who has an individualized education program an individualized summary of performance when the child completes high school. It declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007. I'll note for your reference that this will have a conflict with the bill that we will hear later today, House Bill 2263. It also has a conflict with a bill that we passed out of this committee, Senate Bill 215. It's modifying or the same section, but doesn't actually is crossheads with what this bill is doing, that Senate bill.
So Ledge Council will have to give us some conflict amendments.
Mm-hmm.
If we get that far, they will. All right, thank you. Representative Gelser, you're here to testify. And if there's anyone with you, come on up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Morse, who is my state senator. Good morning. Thank you for having me here. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath. I am pleased to have sponsored this bill, which will fix an inequity that we have across the state of Oregon. Currently, school districts are allowed to choose whether or not to offer a modified diploma to students who do not meet the regular requirements of a diploma. And while under federal law, it is not permissible to create just a special education diploma, this will have a significant impact upon students who are in our special education programs. Currently, in many school districts across the state, there is no modified diploma that those students are able to reach for or achieve. And additionally, many of those students in certain parts of the state are not allowed to participate in graduation ceremonies with their peers, even though they may have worked very hard from the time they were infants entering an early intervention and early childhood special ed program, attending school nearly every day and working hard to meet their IEP goals. This bill would allow them to experience that rite of passage. It would recognize the work that they have completed and the successes that they have achieved meeting their individual goals. There are a couple of parts to the bill. The first is the modified diploma portion, and this simply says that the State Board of Education would develop statewide standards for a modified diploma. This would be helpful for students in a couple of ways. First, if a student starts in one school district and their family moves to another school district, they don't have to start all over again because the requirements are different from school district to school district. As these students are planning for middle school and high school, what it is that they need to do to achieve this goal of a modified diploma, they can count on that consistency from school district to school district. It also means, and Catherine will talk a little bit about this, that modified diploma will mean something. It's not just something that we print up on a piece of paper and give it to someone because they've gone to school. It creates standards that that these students need to strive for. The alternative certificate is for those students who would also not be able to meet the requirements of a modified diploma, likely students with very significant disabilities. The bill allows the local school districts to determine the requirements for this alternative certificate. But again, what this alternative certificate does, and by requiring local school districts to do that, it ensures that students that are working hard, that are moving all the way through the school system, when they reach that peak critique that end of their school experience, they have the ability to have something tangible to take with them to recognize the work that they have done. And finally, the bill does direct school districts to allow these students who have met these goals to be able to participate in commencement ceremonies with the peers that they've attended school with all the way through school. This isn't about kids that can't meet the requirements because they're not showing up at school and they're blowing off their work. These are kids that have significant special needs who are working very hard, and they need the opportunity to be able to strive for a goal and achieve it and to be recognized for that. I was pleased that this bill passed unanimously off the floor of the House, and I'm happy to answer any questions and do hope that you will schedule a work session and move this to the floor of the Senate. It would be a great thing for kids in Oregon to be able to reach for these goals and to achieve them, and for their families to be able to celebrate their successes with them.
Representative Gelser, where does it say in the bill that this is limited to children with disabilities?
Madam Chair, it does not. It cannot. This might also impact students that are in alternative education programs, kids that might have mental health care needs. The federal law prohibits school districts from having, or states from establishing, modified diplomas specifically for students in special education. In function, while this will help some other students as well, the largest population that this would impact are students that are within special education programs and that have disabilities. That's certainly what drew my interest in the bill. There are other populations of students that this might serve.
Well, I understand that, and that's a laudable goal. My concern is that we're going to have school districts issuing these modified diplomas to students who aren't doing the job that they need to do to graduate under a regular diploma. So how do you prevent that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's an excellent question, and I'm glad that you asked the question, because the goal is for that not to happen. That's one of the reasons why it's so important for the State Department of Education to establish the standards for these diplomas. Those standards could include who is eligible, how would you know someone is pursuing that particular type of modified diploma. It also means that you're not just printing something off, as sometimes happens in our school districts now, and saying, this is a modified diploma. I would imagine that the rules that the State Board of Education would adopt around this would include content and curriculum requirements. The development of the bill came out of a work group that included people from the Department of Ed. It included a researcher from the University of Oregon looking at how other states achieve offering the modified diploma, and I believe that their work will go there. But the other reason that we leave so much discretion to the State Board of Ed is to allow them to modify this and adjust this to make sure that it's working well for students, and again, that there are standards that are met, so it's not just a piece of paper that we're giving. It's something that means something, that's available to the kids who need it, and that it keeps them in school, so they're not just quitting because they know that it's not possible for them to achieve the requirements of a regular diploma. It puts something within their grasp that they can really reach for and grab for.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
A couple things, because it's somewhat confusing. It, number one, maybe speaks to our issue with new graduation requirements, but that's separate from this bill. Basically, you're looking at a certificate of completion sort of concept here. But I guess my question is, if we cannot in law target the groups that you're wanting to target, we can do that in rule?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Cruz, I would want to clarify that it's not a certificate of completion. And if I can give you an example, perhaps that will help. And the best example I can give you is my own son, who's going into the sixth grade. He has a developmental disability. What was offered to him in middle school, because students with disabilities don't graduate, is to dig through garbage cans to sort out recycling, to mop the cafeteria floors. He is a kid that reads, he loves social studies, and he loves science. We want him to go to school to learn. It's our job to teach him those types of activities. We have asked, what can we work on for him? What are the appropriate academic goals? What does the modified diploma in this school district look like, so that we can start in middle school making sure that he's building the skills that he needs in math, reading, social studies, to achieve the types of credits that he can? Currently, no such structure exists to be able to help these students achieve academic academic certificates. The point of the modified diploma, it's going to be hard to get. It's not going to be an easy thing that any child is able to achieve. It's going to be something that they have to work hard for, that's going to require planning, that's going to have content and curricular goals. The alternative certificate, which the local school districts would put together, would be something more similar to a certificate of completion. And that would be for those children that despite working very hard, perhaps for that modified diploma, they just cannot reach the standards that are there for that modified diploma. And I think Catherine is going to be able to speak more clearly to what the difference is there and why this actually increases standards for these students and allows them to have better academic gains and make sure that these things actually mean something. And finally, the reason that it needs to be in law, right now having it in a discretionary kind of way means that some school districts are choosing not to offer these things at all. And so these kids, they go through school all the way through. There's nothing for them to tack goals to. There's nothing for them to work towards. They're prohibited from participating in graduation ceremonies, and they receive no sort of certificate of completion. And that's simply wrong for these kids that are working very hard.
Madam Chair, it still gets down to the point of, because you said, I mean, whether you call it profiling or whatever, but we know that the students that we're trying to reach with this, and you say that we cannot make that reference in statute because we violate federal law. How can we do that in rule without violating federal law?
Vice Chair Cruz, Senator Walker, the way that you do it in rule is as guidance counselors and others are helping students plan their goals, they're going to help students know what kind of diploma it is that they are working towards. A student that's just not cutting it, which I think is what part of the concern is, that they're just not trying, they're not going to be in there working with a guidance counselor or with others to develop a plan to help them achieve the standards that are set out in that modified diploma. There might be kids that are chronically ill. There might be children that have mental illness. There might be children that are bouncing from foster care to foster care for whom achieving the credits for a regular diploma due to no fault of their own, it might not be possible for them. Those are some of the other kinds of kids for whom this might be helpful.
I'm sure just because it still gets back to the point that you are going to be asking the Department of Education to promulgate rules to make sure that we're targeting the right population so that others aren't slipping in or that we're making sure. And I guess I what I'm not understanding is if the ORSs would violate federal law, how the OARs would not also violate federal law.
Vice Chair Cruz, Senator Walker, the rules will not specifically reference that this is a special education diploma. It will refer to these as a modified diploma. What you can't do in federal law is say that it's a special education diploma. And in fact, this bill states that the modified diploma itself cannot state that it is a special education diploma.
Are there any other states that do this, Representative Gelser?
Yes.
Okay. Well, why don't we hear from your guest here?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon DD Coalition. This is an issue that we have discussed for quite a number of years. Currently, Oregon is actually, since the beginning of the SIM and the CAM and the early school reform issues, Oregon in statute really only has one diploma, and that is the standard diploma. It allows school districts to issue other alternative certificates. And those, when we looked at the most recent data, out of 287 high schools, only 118 of those schools did not issue anything except a standard diploma. So out of those 287 high schools, 118 only issued a standard diploma. For many students who are unable to reach the goals of a standard diploma, which is obviously something we are all in favor of and we are all pushing, but if you look at the dropout rates, you see high numbers of students who are not reaching the standard diploma level. The modified diploma is something that has been discussed as an alternative way of keeping kids in school with the idea that there is a diploma that they can achieve that would have specific criteria, statewide criteria. And let me give you an example of Salem's Kaiser School District, which does issue a modified diploma. It has very specific credits that are required to achieve that diploma, the language credits, the science credits, etc. It may have more flexibility in how those credits get achieved, and the number of courses, there's a slightly different configuration of some of the courses. It is not a special education diploma specifically. It does pick up non-English learners. It picks up, as Representative Gelser mentioned, students for whom maybe several credits short of actually getting that standard diploma, but it is still an academic achievement. We worked on this for quite a number of months, looking at what other states provided, looking at what was actually provided in Oregon. We went on websites all over the state to see what was being done. Some school districts issued a modified diploma, and they called it a special education diploma, clearly in violation of federal law. It was on their websites. Many schools offered alternative certificates, and for those alternative certificates, they picked up programs that were alternative programs for kids who really struggled with school and struggled with the structure in education, and they had alternative certificates. One of the things that we identified was the fact that the modified diploma for students who could not reach that standard diploma differed throughout the state. School districts didn't provide it. Students moved from district to district. The criteria, if it was offered, was different, or it might not be offered at all. We have many, many students who left school without any kind of diploma, no kind of certificate, as they left school. And I want to just give a very specific personal example. I have two children who exited school at the very same time. My daughter left high school, went to a large urban high school, left high school at the end of the 12th grade, graduated with honors, attended a big, big graduation ceremony. My son left school at the age of 21 after almost 20 years in special education. His last day of school, in his backpack, there was a mimeographed, which kind of showed how old it was, a mimeographed piece of paper that said certificate of attendance with his name written in it and the teacher's name. That was the end of his 20 years of educational experience. My daughter was outraged because she knew the kind of work that my son had gone through, what he had done, and what he had achieved in those years of school. So, well, we wrote a letter to the superintendent and pointed out the fact that this was an incredible inequity and disrespectful of kids who couldn't achieve a standard diploma. By return mail, we received, you know, the standard plastic leather container with a satin background and the beautifully lettered modified diploma with a superintendent's certificate. And that pointed out to me that the modified diploma, which had been given to him just because his mother and sister wrote a letter, was meaningless. And we looked in statute to see if these modified diplomas that were being given to students who could not achieve a regular diploma had any meaning to them. And there is nothing in statute. We believe that it's very important for many reasons. Employers are confused. We do a lot of work with programs that are post-secondary programs. They're confused because they mean nothing in statute. They mean nothing statewide. There's no uniformity to students, for students, for parents, and for employers. We recognize the value and the importance of the regular diploma. Many programs, post-secondary education and many other programs, do not accept a modified diploma or any kind of alternative certificate. However, if we had a statewide criteria for a modified diploma, we are in much better position to show future employers to show future post-secondary programs what the educational achievement is with a modified diploma. And frankly, as we increase academic standards, we're faced, and the Department of Education has formed a work group to look at a modified diploma. They are working on establishing standards to present that would address this issue of students who simply cannot achieve the requirements of the standard diploma but deserve to leave school with a uniform certificate that is recognized statewide for what it means and the achievements.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. White. Colleagues, Representative Clem needs to be heard before 8:30, so I'm going to recess this, close the public hearing on this right now, and Representative Gelser, I know you're doing opening ceremonies or something, so Ms. White, if you can stick around, we're going to try to get someone from the Department of Ed here as well. So I'm just going to recess this hearing. Thank you both for
coming.
Thank
you very much.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2848. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2729. Ms. Richardson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2729A authorizes the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to establish the Access to Student Assistance Programs in Reach of Everyone, better known as ASPIRE. It establishes the ASPIRE program fund within the general fund that continuously appropriates monies in the fund to the commission for the program, declares an emergency. It would take effect July 1st, 2007.
Okay. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
And, you know, I guess Representative Robin may not be joining us, but he is the other chief co-sponsor of this bill.
If he comes in the room, I'll have him come up.
Good. As some of you know, I was chair of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for the, 2002 to 2006, and was on commission from 2000 to 2006. And one of the programs that's housed at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission that was incubated and created there within the broader statutory authority the commission has to help students find their way to college is the ASPIRE program. Started back in 99 and was just getting going when I got on the commission, and it was really one of my great sources of pride about the work done at the commission to have this program blossom and flower there. Part of the challenge was the program has always been entirely privately funded and has never technically existed except by sort of commission rule and policy, but doesn't exist in the statute. So there were many times when I would speak to some of the foundations who were funding this program, and they would say, you know, are we sure this is going to be here next year? It doesn't have any statutes. It doesn't have any budget other than what we give it, and yet it seems to be working so well. And there's been a number of efforts each session to try and have the ASPIRE program placed in statute and attain some general funding, not been particularly successful due to other large investments the legislature made in the Oregon Opportunity Grant, for example, in the last several biennium. And this time it's really gathered momentum, been a priority of a lot of folks in the building, certainly, to acknowledge the work that ASPIRE has been doing and also say we want this as many places as we possibly can get it. The way that ASPIRE works is, any of you who've toured an ASPIRE high school know, is there is a person on staff who typically had been funded by AmeriCorps with a little bit of a match from a local school district, and they grassroots organize volunteers from the community to come in and counsel high school students during the last couple of years of their career to get their financial aid forms done, get their applications done, help them with their essays, talk to them about any challenge they may have, whether it's sort of financial or academic, and counsel them on how to get the right resources, but always pushing them to try and go on to a post-secondary education if that's what they wish. As you know, a lot of our counselors today are dealing with such major problems that are societal, and they have caseloads of 400 and 500 per counselor, that they don't necessarily have time to do the kind of career slash post-secondary education coaching that once was done in the high schools. And ASPIRE has really stepped in to fill that need. The program has grown on its own from 606 students served in 99-01 to 39,450 served in the last biennium. From 173 volunteers in 99 and 01 to 1,100 in the last biennium. So it's really a success story that has done very well. But again, I've sat and talked to foundation presidents a number of times about the need, now that the program's been proven through their incubation dollars, for the state to assume some meager, at least, role in funding the success of the program. And the way we've really packaged this is, let's expand with the state money. So rather than supplant what the foundations have been doing, let's go into more high schools with an additional state investment, so it really gets something new for members. And of course, that's going to be a ways and means question, so I know that do we have somebody here on the...
Both Senator Morse and myself on ways and means, and we are actually discussing that right now. And the thing that I worry about, and don't get me wrong, I love the Aspire program. I think it's extremely valuable. But what I worry about is you get enough money from these private donations and grants, and the state just drops off their investment, which they've been known to do.
Well, what would happen in that case is schools who had started up their programs would either say, well, I guess we're not going to be able to do this. And we kind of do it in a waiting list fashion, so the people who were enhanced by the state, if they dropped off their investment, they may get creative and figure out how to raise community support once they've clearly seen the value to their students. But, you know, they may, like any program, move back down the waiting list and put them back on the waiting list from a functioning program. The key thing about this bill is it doesn't actually appropriate money.
Right.
What it does is create a fund that set up where monies may go. But it also is a very strong statement to the foundations that the state does believe in this program enough to have it exist somewhere in our statutory framework rather than just sort of as a commission activity and a commission policy. And I've had foundation folks in the past just ask for that. Can you please ensure us this isn't going to go away in 30 days by some rule change, because we've invested, you know, millions and millions of dollars in this thing. So we had this discussion a little bit on the House side. You know, this doesn't appropriate money. Do we need this bill without money? And I would argue that we do, to establish that it is the policy of the state, that we think it's a good program, and we believe it should exist, and it should be a legislative decision to have it go away, if it were to go away. But I hope it doesn't, because there's not really a good option, as you'll hear in the testimony right now in a lot of schools, to really have one-on-one sit-down time with someone to think about going to college. And there's been, you know, wonderful stories. I hope some of the students are here, of people who just really thought they were about to drop out and are now, you know, just getting ready to graduate from college. And their Aspire mentor, the volunteer, who is someone who often was maybe an educator or business person in the community, and they're using their retirement or spare time, and it adds to both of their lives significantly to be able to help someone and certainly get the assistance when you're a young student.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I was not going to college because we were very, very poor, and I just didn't think it was in my future. And my high school counselor, who was actually dying of Lou Gehrig's disease at the time, took me on as his little project and said, "You're too smart not to go to college," and said, "There's a lot of free money out there for you." So I got the Oregon Opportunity Grant,
smart,
which was the need grant then. And he helped me fill out all those forms. Back in the 70s, they weren't quite as complicated as they are today. But that FAFSA is really intimidating. And my children are now, my daughter's in graduate school, my son's applied. And they called me up and said, "I'm having trouble understanding this FAFSA." And they're in their 20s. And, you know, I did it when they were in college.
Right.
I'm one of those enabling kind of mothers. But, you know, and that's what Aspire does. Aspire helps the students sit down and try to figure out, yeah, you can go to college, and here's what you do. And you're right. There's a lot of volunteers that do it right now, but it would be better if it could be more widespread across the state. And I see Representative Roblin has joined us, and I bet you have to hurry as well. So
I may dart out, if I may. And I mean, if that's all right, and all, because I have a Ways and Means and Floor session. But I just want to comment on that last point. You're absolutely right. I myself got the Oregon Opportunity Grant as well, and it really helped. The problem is,
you're much younger than me, so it's called the Oregon Opportunity Grant when you got it, and
it was
the need grant when I had it.
It was still the need grant. They changed it a couple years after I got it. But what does happen, and Representative Roblin knows this, my mom is the career, or was the career development person at my high school. She would talk to people about going to college, but she was so busy that she didn't even talk to me about some of the things, so I didn't take the pre-SAT because I didn't realize I really needed to. I was thinking about sports and dating and all that stuff, and I just, my own parent wasn't able to get me to focus on everything I needed to do to go to college. And so sometimes it's not even the financial means, because that was sitting there waiting based on need, but just the, you need to focus and do your applications, Brian, and take the tests. And, you know, I'm certain there are others out there who have, you know, the attention span that I had at age 16.
Yeah, and wasn't Representative Roble your principal?
He was.
So he has some stories to leave, so you could go now.
Yeah, I think
that's about.
Actually, to his credit, he almost always gives a certain person. To Brian's credit, he always tells the story first so that he can embellish the way he wants it.
Revisionist history.
That's right. For the record, I am State Representative Arnie Roblin from District 9 in Coos Bay. This bill is one of those that I brought last session, actually, and it didn't get a hearing. It didn't move. There were a bunch of things that were happening in the House at that time, so it did not move forward. And
nothing's changed, has it?
Things have changed.
Things are still happening.
It continues to be a really outstanding bill, and the issue is that as a high school principal, trying to make sure that every student in your school gets the information they need to help them prepare for the rest of their life is one of the things that is really important to me. And I've told people many times that I was that ADHD dyslexic kid growing up, and school was not easy for me as a young child. And eventually I got better, and I had parents that were very supportive and tried to put me in the position that I could, and I found individual teachers that helped me move along, and math became my saving grace with respect to school. And by the time I got into high school, I was programmed for college, and I knew I was going to do that. It was going to be something, and there were community colleges in my local area, so I knew I could afford it, coming from a family that didn't have that much money, expendable money, and five kids. It was one of those things that I saw a path, and I figured out how I was going to get there, and I didn't veer from that path much. I've had the opportunity with my own kids to give them other opportunities so they can do some things, and I think every parent's dream is that they can help their children reach their potential, and I expect that that's every teacher's dream. But as times have gotten harder and harder to bring the information necessary for people to make that step. And if you're from a family that has never gone to college, it's mind-boggling to think about filling out the federal aid forms and all those other things that you have to do. And so it's easier sometimes to just go get that job out of school or go other places, some of which are great opportunities. But it's rather than just being an opportunity, it's the only choice. And what Aspire does is it takes people in our community who wouldn't necessarily come to the school, trains them, and that's probably the most important thing. When I first saw this and it came to our school, and we actually applied and were denied the first time, so we worked harder and applied the next time to get accepted into the Aspire program. The beauty of it is that there is a plan to train people who are walking into your to be knowledgeable volunteers that help kids on an individual basis. And it also shows them what lines you don't cross and how you set up the appointments, and it develops an agreement with the school that you're going to have place set aside for this to happen. It has thought of all the things that need to be thought of to make it successful. And then they're there with the support to continue it being successful. And what kids start to find out if they get involved, and hopefully we'll get, there's programs all the way down to the ninth grade, not everybody uses that, but people will start to understand what it takes to get yourself prepared for the next step. And for those kids that really want to go on to the Ivy League school, that's a process that really needs to start at the latest by your freshman year, and to get to stay in place to do that. If you're wanting to go to the community college, it's still important you're planning at a reasonable time, and it's never too early to start taking the right courses and planning the right things and doing the things. And with Aspire, those people come in, oftentimes community members who bring their own expertise and walk into that building. They see the school, they get connected back to the school that we like them being connected, and then they get connected with individuals. My daughter, actually, her Aspire volunteer is sitting in the room, and we'll probably be speaking to you in a little later, Katty McEwen, who now works as the Aspire director right now. And she, I will tell you, it is much easier for your child to talk to another person than it is for you to talk to your child about the same things at that particular time in life, and to broach the questions and to talk about what kinds of things you have to do to prepare yourself to get to that next step. We went from being successful with a few of our students with respect to some of these selective scholarships to being amazingly successful for those kids who really were qualified and ready to do it but didn't have all the little skills they needed to write those letters, to follow through time after time on their timeline to get where they needed to be. So when it comes to Ford Family Foundation scholarships, the number of kids that have been successful at our school because of Aspire has risen. I think we used to get one every couple years. We have had situations where two and three of our kids are getting those. There are scholarships that if you are a if you go to your local golf pros and you become a caddy, there are scholarships for those kids that do well in school and caddy that give full rides to state schools, and they can talk to you about that. Many of those things we wouldn't have known about if it weren't for having this kind of program, Aspire, there. So from my perspective, what we are doing now is we're setting the groundwork so that the organization for which it's involved in OSAC and Aspire can continue that process of getting more and more schools, and eventually every high school in the state of Oregon, it would be my dream, would be having the same opportunities to help their kids understand what the potential is, their potential is, and where they can go after high school. So with that, I really implore you to listen to the testimony, pass this bill, and get it on to being an institutional part of what we do to help kids in this educational endeavor. Thank you. Any questions?
Questions? Representative Wilburn, thank you.
Thank you.
I haven't seen you since 15 minutes ago.
Thank you very much, and have a great day. And you have some wonderful people coming to talk to you. I didn't see. Is Vicki here? Merkel? Oh, there's Vicki. And I said this over in the house, and I will say it to one just before I leave. Vicki Merkel is probably the single, best facilitator at organizing and training people that I've ever seen in my life. And she was the original person that helped get this to happen. She designed the programs. The materials you're going to see that walk through training of people is all a creation of Vicki's many years of working with volunteers things and making it work. And I will tell you, as a person who's tried to work with volunteers for years, there is no one that I have ever met that understands what needs to be done to make a volunteer program work like Vicki Merkel. So have a great day.
Thank you. Next, call up Margie Lowe, Denise Johnson, and Vicki Merkel. Dennis Johnson, excuse me. I took a shot on that one. I wasn't sure. And proceed as you wish.
Good morning, committee. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Margie Lowe. I'm with the Office of the Governor. I'm here this morning to speak in support of House Bill 2729A, the Aspire Bill. This program is an important component of the Governor's wider proposals around education. Many of you have heard about our proposals to improve the outcomes in terms of high school graduation, our efforts to increase post-secondary access and affordability through the shared responsibility model. We really see the Aspire program as an important link between those two endeavors. It will help us to better reinforce why students need to take those harder courses while they're in high school to better prepare themselves for college. In order for them to want to prepare themselves for college, they need to believe the college is something that's attainable for them, that it's not something that other kids will experience, but rather that they can experience. The folks who help with the Aspire program, right now we're in over 80 schools. The governor's recommended budget would take us to at least 150 schools in the 07-09 biennium. Will help provide more information to students. And unlike some of the programs that are offered in high schools that I've experienced where they focus mostly on the senior class, the Aspire program starts with students as freshmen and really helps mentor those students throughout their high school career so that they can make good choices throughout the 4 years that really have them prepared for as wide a range of choices post-graduation as possible. One of the things that has been mentioned before is the daunting tasks that are required, not just in terms of your coursework, when you're finishing high school, but also all of the paperwork that's necessary in terms of college applications, financial aid applications, scholarship applications. There's a lot of process, and if you're new to that landscape, it's a foreign land that you really don't understand how to do it successfully. Aspire Mentors will help coach these students so that they better understand that context. Right now, we're seeing some trends that are concerning, and I was sharing this with Senator Walker yesterday afternoon. Our number of FAFSA applications is declining for the last 2 years in our key target populations, that lower income strata of students that we hope to have really access the shared responsibility model. We don't exactly understand why their application process for the FAFSA is down. Those mentors in the high schools will better help support that process. As Senator Walker's already shared, filling out the FAFSA form is, in my perspective, a harder chore to do than doing my taxes.
With the FAFSA, you also have to do your taxes.
Yes.
You have to provide that income. I do my children's taxes still. And they called and they said, well, Mom, if you haven't done our tax return, we need it because we have to fill out the FAFSA. I'm like, okay. So I just quickly sketched out what it would be. And I said, here's what it'll be. I'll get it to you in a couple of weeks. But you're right. But the parents, if you're a parent, if you're a child still at home, able to be deducted on your parents' tax return, you got to not only have your own tax return, but your parents' tax return completed, or at least estimated. And that's hard. You have to estimate your net worth. I mean, if you have a business like I do, it's very complicated. You're exactly right.
Madam Chair, I couldn't agree more. It's a very complex process. And then you add to that financial aid application process, the college application processes, and to that then also the scholarship application processes.
Right.
That's a lot of, and you know, there's not a class offered in a high school on how to do the paperwork.
Oh, and I think Senator Westland has a young student headed to college. You're starting to do all this, are you not?
If I could, Madam Chair, a clarification. You have to do both your taxes and the FAFSA form. It's not either or?
Right.
Oh, Madam Chair, could I?
I could actually assist you, Senator, if you need it. Don't forget that sort of thing.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Westland, one of the things that we know is that if you haven't done it before as either a parent or as a student, you really do need a translator. And that's where the Aspire program really provides some critical support. And if you're child is the first in your family to go to college, you don't have someone who's been through the process who can help explain some of what's ahead. That's where the school resources, and because of the budget reductions, the counseling offices just don't have the resources. It's important to pull in these community folks. So we really support this program. We think it's really important to make the high school diploma project successful, the shared responsibility successful, and subsequently, all of these students as successful as possible, which really helps the whole state of Oregon. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I just point out, my daughter started building her portfolio in middle school, and of course she had the benefit of being valedictorian, which didn't hurt, I don't think. But she went to Willamette, which is an expensive school, but she had scholarships and grants that paid for all but about $3,000 a year of that, which was very, very helpful from my perspective. But you're right, there are an amazing number of little niche scholarships, the universe of opportunity for funding for higher ed is rather large, and I just don't think very many people could navigate that on their own without somebody who knows where all of those little pots of money are.
And there's a number of scam artists out there as well, waiting on the web, lurking about, saying, you know, give us your money and we'll help you find all these places to find money to go to college.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I'm sure in your daughter's navigating that process so successfully, One of the things that was really important for her to have is somebody who was a cheerleader to support her through that. Having two children who are in college myself, I certainly saw the experience that their enthusiasm and commitment to doing it starts to wane when they have to wait those many months between application and any information about were they successful. And in order to stay at the task, you need somebody to say, you know, well, maybe you didn't win that one, but your odds are just as good for the next one. And again, that's an important thing for the mentors along with parents to do.
Yeah, on support structure, I mean, you know, she had the benefit of the fact that I had graduated from that place and kind of knew some of the framework. So that was very helpful as well. But not everybody necessarily has that asset at home, so...
Okay, well, we better hurry along. We're, like, out of time, running out of time. Have you all had a chance to speak?
No.
Oh, see, well, we have a whole list of people signed up who all love the Aspire program, and I think it's clear the committee likes it. So can you just keep your comments really brief, sir?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Johnson, Executive Director at the Student Assistance Commission. I would call your attention to two items right now. The letter of support from State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Susan Castillo. It's a wonderful letter of endorsement. The second to the last paragraph, I think, tells you something very important. And it mentions that Aspire does not serve just the high-achieving students who are going to get those scholarships that we've been talking about here, nor does it serve just the students at the other end, the at-risk students, but it is a program for all comers. And that motto at the bottom of her stationery, every student, every day, a success, that could almost be a motto for the Aspire program. That's what we aspire to do with this program. The other item I would call your attention to is the last page of the handout that has a colored map on the top. The colored map shows the 83 high schools that we're working in right now. The last page says what this bill does. HB 2729A, as Representative Clem said, represents or would establish Aspire in statute. Then our budget bill for OSAC, HB 5044, would provide general funding. This is from the governor's recommended budget. Recommended funding for expansion from the current level of 80-some schools to 150 or so by the end of the coming biennium. The staffing is a shared responsibility between the program and the school, and the training and the resources you've already heard alluded to. We'll have somebody else speak shortly about outcomes and evaluating and how we make sure that state funds are spent wisely. I could go on, but I'm not going to.
I think that's enough. That's great. Thank you. This is good. I appreciate this information. I found that very productive. Ms. Merkel.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'll be very brief because when I get started, we could take a very long time talking about Aspire. I just want to mention the volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
What the statute does is provides the framework for the program. The budget request for OSAC provides the funding for the staffing framework, but really the engine for this program are the volunteers out in the schools. And I designed the program specifically for sustainability if funding would go away, because it was initially funded by soft dollars. And that's the reason the volunteers belong to the school, not to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. We have a written agreement with the school that is signed by the school superintendent and the principal, and the schools take the risk management, they recruit the volunteers, and provide the ongoing support. So I did want to mention that. Thank you for your time.
Oh, that's really important as well. And I know there were lots of volunteers. We can't run our schools without parent volunteers. I'll tell you that. Okay, thank you. I'll hear very quickly from Xavier Torres, Patrick Gabel, and Matt Uman. If you don't all know each other, you're going to shake hands, say hello.
Quick question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
While they're getting settled. What is your pin on your lapel, the lower pin?
Phi Beta Kappa.
Very good. Probably says something about me that I don't know what that looks like.
Okay. Yeah, it probably does, Senator. I didn't know either. Gentlemen, if you're here with written testimony, please don't read it. Just give me a 1 minute. We've got a bunch of folks and a big hearing, and I think we're going to pass the bill. So can you start on the end here?
I think, actually,
Okay. You can start at that end. That's fine with me, but just make it really brief.
Chair Walker, members of the Education Subcommittee, thank you for hearing me today. My name is Javier Torres. I'm currently a student at Mount Hood Community College. I'm going to make this brief and short. I am also a mentor at Clackamas High School. I've been doing that for the last 4 years. I can't tell you the importance enough of, especially somebody young like my age, at being able to speak with these students on what it is to they need to go through, from the FAFSA all the way to students I've met that don't even think that they're even going to be moving on to college. Some students say, hey, I just want to be a truck driver. What do I need to do that? I'll get them an IITR if I have to. I mean, just having that personal experience with a student and seeing the outcomes of what funding is out there that they thought they never had, especially for first-generation students, I've seen a huge impact of what that's done. Along with that, I just cannot stress the importance of how the Oregon higher education system today is facing a crisis, and we need more educated workers in the workforce as we need today, and the Aspire program is where we need to start, so that way we can push them along through to achieving each and every one of their individual goals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Torres. Thank you for being a volunteer. I appreciate it.
Madam Chair, just a really quick comment. Mm-hmm. Mr. Torres joined us. Frank, Senator Morris will recognize Mr. Torres. You joined us at the Clackamas Ways and Means Town Hall presentation, I believe, and you did an excellent job there, as you did here today.
Thank you very much, Chair Walker and Senator Wesson. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Chair Walker, members of the committee. My name is Matt Lehman. I'm a second-year law student, actually third-year law student. I just took my last exam yesterday.
Oh, that's an L.
At the University of Oregon
School
of Law.
Don't write very well. I'm sorry. You're going to have to learn to write better in law school. You're going to make it.
I learned that from my father. I can't.
I was just going to ask, now that I know you're Matt Lehman, you're Mike Lehman's son.
Do I have to admit that on the
Yes, record? You do.
Oh, my God.
Don't tell my son.
Okay, I got to leave, Madam Chair.
Yeah, yeah. We got to change the air in our spare tire, Madam Chair. We got
to
go.
He gave me permission to say, because he knew you guys would probably know him, I obviously needed Aspire, seeing as who my father was.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I didn't have a lot of help, you know. But
but your mother's a teacher, is she not?
Yeah, she kind of cracked the whip and made me get the stuff. But Aspire was a big help. It was, I think I offer a little bit of a unique perspective. I ended up graduating from Willamette University in 2005. And the two things I learned from Aspire, and they're very important to me, is one, that gets you going. I mean, your senior year in high school, you kind of are floating through your classes, you're getting done with stuff, you're wrapping up, you're like, what am I going to do? Everyone's talking about what's going to happen next. And you kind of lose that focus. And the main thing that Marilyn Lewis, my Aspire advisor, did was get me focused on what was important. That's getting scholarships, picking the school, looking at things you don't necessarily look at all the time. Like, I wanted to play soccer in college, and Willamette offered a program that was perfect because I wanted to be involved in politics and offered a soccer program I could probably play at. So things like that I looked at. The other thing that Aspire helped me out more than anything else was giving me that structure when I did other things. I applied to 5 law schools, which required taking the LSAT and writing personal statements, and then trying to find funding. And each year I've managed to get individual or private scholarships for the coming year. I got $5,000 for a scholarship this year, and it's the same one I'm going to have next year too. And then I got a scholarship through the Dean's Funds, and that's only because I applied on time and I looked at what scholarships were available. The only reason I knew that was because I had Aspire, and that if I didn't have that guidance when I was in high school, I wouldn't have had that ability when I was in college either, despite my parents.
Despite your parents. Well,
thank you very much.
Do give your father our best wishes. He served ably here in the legislature, and I do miss his company. Thank you.
Thank you. I will pass it along.
All right.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Beisel, for the record. And
don't write very well either, young man.
And I attend Portland State University. My apologies for my poor penmanship. I attended Grant High School, which is in the northeast Portland side of town. And the reality of the situation that we're facing is that in terms of college, it's hard for students, especially if you're a first-generation student. If your parents didn't go to college, it's extremely difficult for you to get the information that you need to attend college successfully. I mean, Javier spoke about this, but it's not, the Aspire program is not just for, merit-geared students, students that are already in the AP classes and the honors programs. It's for first-generation students, students of color. It's for all students, right? I was a student that came from a low-income background, but I'm obviously not a student of color, right? It's for all students. And I had no intention of going to college, I'll be honest. I was really burnt out on education, and I hadn't had a good experience in the schools that I had attended. And when I sat down with my advisor, whose name was Deborah, who was just a volunteer, she had a student that graduated from Lincoln High School a couple of years before. She was just a student parent, or not a student parent, parent of a student. And she sat me down, and we just talked. It wasn't anything like I'd experienced before with my counselor, who was trying to push me into a college. Preferably an Ivy League was what she wanted me to attend, and I wanted nothing to do with it. But Deborah sat me down, and we looked at nonprofits, we looked at community colleges, we looked at joining the workforce early. And that sort of an attitude and perspective allowed me the opportunity to sort of reflect and rethink my options. And inevitably, I did attend college, but only because of Deborah and the Aspire program was I able to make that shift. I applied to all sorts of schools. I applied to about 12 of them. Because of Deborah's help, she read my essay. She helped me look at scholarships. She helped me fill out the FAFSA, as you were talking about before. The unfortunate side of things was I didn't get into any of the colleges I applied to, which was, understandably devastating. And my counselor, who was busy, keeping students in high school, and my parents, who were busy working, the only person I could really turn to was Deborah. The only person who was there for me at a time in my life which was really difficult was, ironically, my Aspire counselor, who my mother asked me to go see. So,
well, thank you, Mr. Bison.
Yeah, I just wanted to put that out there.
Hurry it up, but we appreciate Deborah as well because we're glad you're in school. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Torres,
can
very
I say
quickly?
One thing to Senator Metzger? My mom would kill me. She said to say hi. She was in the band with you at Centennial High School.
Oh, my goodness.
Mr.
Your mom?
Torres.
Oh, really?
I told her I'd be seeing you today, so.
All right. We want stories. We want stories. Yeah.
I think we should dismiss Mr. Torres at this moment.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Okay, very quickly, please. David Mesereau, Alicia Lund, and Katie McEwen. Very, very quickly. We just can't spend any more time on this. I'm sorry. You have written testimony. We'll read it. Give us your short couple of paragraphs why you love this program. Sir.
My name is David Mesereau. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm here with the advice from Senator Westland's staff. My testimony is simply squeak, squeak, squeak. The advice was, those are the people that get attention. If you're cranky and squeaking, you get some legislative attention. So I'm here to squeak.
Well, actually, the cranky part's not necessary.
Well,
and if you're cranky, you'd get nothing. So I want a smile and a squeak.
I simply want to say that as a person who served on the commission with Brian Klun.
Okay.
I was there at the creation of the Aspire program. I've now served in every volunteer position that the Aspire program has. I taught in the public schools for 36 years. I'm familiar with its impact. If you look at what life would be like without the Aspire program, it's the difference between traveling on a developed highway, going to a specific destination with lots of support versus wandering around in the desert, occasionally coming up against a watering hole and struggling to find some direction. That's been testified by people here already. I simply want to support what they've said as well.
Thank you, Mr. Mesereau. And very quickly,
Hi, my name is Alicia Lachey, and it's not because I have poor penmanship.
Oh, yeah, it's my reading. So I'm getting hints from our committee that we need to hurry along. So
I will make this very brief. I live in Portland. I'm here. I've worn many hats for Aspire. One of them is role of evaluator. I've also sat on the advisory team. I want to draw your attention to two issues in particular. One is that of post-secondary enrollment rate. The other is scholarship application. I did an evaluation study for Aspire in academic 2002-03. One thing I found was that students from Aspire high schools were more likely to enroll in Oregon's post-secondary education institutions than students from other Oregon high schools when taking into account the effects of poverty and racial and ethnic distribution within the schools. It is necessary to include the control variables because of the heavy impact of socioeconomic issues. Straight percentage comparisons aren't necessarily meaningful, but please look at the table below where I did provide you some straight percentage comparisons. You'll see that on average during the early years of the program, post-secondary enrollment was actually higher in Aspire schools. The early analysis indicates that for each additional year Aspire is in a school, the Oregon post-secondary enrollment rate can be expected to increase. Scholarship applicants. One of the things I also found was that graduates from Aspire high schools were more likely to apply for scholarships that were administered by OSAC's private awards program than students from other Oregon high schools. Specifically, in the classes of 1999, 2000, 2000, and 2003, graduates who applied for scholarships administered by OSAC were also more likely to receive awards than applicants from other Oregon high schools. The analysis allowed, I was able to look at individual students to get the school level differences. I did not isolate individual students who were mentored. I didn't introduce control variables because of the high impact of GPA. But for the last year, I analyzed 2003, 19% of graduates from Aspire high schools applied for scholarships administered through OSAC's private awards program, compared to 15% from other Oregon high schools.
Okay, Ms. Lachey, I can't take any more statistics.
Okay, I just want to point out, if you look to the bottom of page 2, you'll find a list of some things that students have said would improve Aspire. So please take a look at that. I also want to point out on page 3, I've identified two studies external that help to understand how Aspire works. So please take a look at that.
Well, we have this right here in front of us, so I need to move on. Thank you very much. Ms. McEwen?
Yes, good morning.
I'm sorry. Short.
Very short. Chair Walker, Senators, I'm happy to be here today. I'm very passionate about this program. I've served as a volunteer, initiated a program, a precursor to Aspire at Marshfield High School. Aspire came along. We became a pilot school under the tutelage of Representative Roblin. And I have seen this work one student at a time very successfully. I think one thing that hasn't been addressed today in the testimony that you've heard, and you can read my written testimony about students that I've worked with and the things that I've gained and that they've gained from that, but Aspire is a response to a need in Oregon. I sat as a school board member for 11 years. We closed 7 elementary schools and reduced staff. That's changing. We see the tide changing. Staff is going to increase again with the support that you are all providing at K-12 level. Counselors tend to come back last. The classroom will be impacted first. We are still in an issue with counseling offices in Oregon where their loads are high. One thing that I want you to be sure and think about is I work in a number of schools in Oregon of the 83 that are small rural schools where there is no counselor at all. There is no one in that school that has expertise in this college access process. Aspire goes into those schools, works with a designated staff member, trains that staff member, and you would be surprised to know that a lot of people have no knowledge about post-secondary access when we go into the building. And we provide services in those smaller schools that do not offer at all. And it's something that has not come up. In the larger schools where they do have counseling, the loads are 300 to 500 students, we still offer an amazing ability to extend and enhance the reach of what the counselors can do. But there are schools for whom we become even more significant when the personnel in the building does not exist at all. And that's something that hasn't come up.
Okay.
As a parent, this is a fabulous program. As a school board member, that community partnership is invaluable. As a staff person with Aspire, we're at 83. We need to go to 150. We can provide tremendous opportunities for kids in this state. And with the state on the cusp of growth, I think we're in a position right now to be poised to increase Aspire with your support and move on and just double the number of students that we can serve in the next biennium. So I appreciate your support.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm sorry I have to cut you off. Mr. Choi, you've got 30 seconds. I'm sorry, but we have a bunch of bills here that have got to be heard today.
You bet.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll make this very, very brief. For the record, my name is Randy Choi, and I'm the Program Officer for Education and Special Funds at the Oregon Community Foundation, the state's largest charitable organization. And basically, on behalf of the foundation, I just want to express my personal as well as our foundation's strong support for not only the Aspire program, but also the growth and expansion of Aspire and getting it established in statute for the very first time. Providing access to post-secondary education is one of the foundation's highest priorities, and the Aspire program complements our major scholarship program very nicely. We're very proud of the Aspire program. As a matter of fact, we helped start the Aspire program 9 years ago in partnership with OSAC, and we have continued to support it during those 9 years. But at this time, we really feel that it is time for the state to step forward in a major way to support the program by placing it in statute and providing enough funding to grow it from the 83 or 84 high schools to 150 over the next 2 years. It's time now to have Aspire in statute to build its credibility, build its visibility, and also support its long-term sustainability, and that's why we support House Bill 2729A. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you, and we'd love to see it grow now and into the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Choi, and thank you for your foundation's help in getting this program started. Yes, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we know to whom we can give credit for this program? I'm curious. Was that shared with us? Who originated Aspire?
The program?
Do we know?
I think it's Vicki Merkley. Vicki, come on up.
Well, I was just wanting to give credit.
Well,
because
and I want Vicki to come up so you can do that. Ms. Merkley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was passed a note that suggested we put on the record that, in fact, Aspire is unique of all 50 states. And so I wanted to acknowledge whoever the creator was of this program and appropriately recognize that in the public forum. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Merkel.
Thank you, Chair Walker and members of the committee, and it's truly an honor and a pleasure to have worked on this program. I'm one of those kids that no one asked me the question, can you go to college? I grew up in a time when girls didn't go to college, especially daughters of mill workers over in Dallas, just 15 miles down the road. Suddenly money became available for me. Unfortunately, through my father's death, I had Social Security benefits, and the question came forward. Can you go, you know, do you want to go to college? But I didn't think about it as a statement until someone said, you can go to college. And I think going to college not only changed my family culture, because my kids have now graduated, but I do think I've helped in some small way here to change my community. So thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is way cool. Thank you. I was the first person in my family to go to college, too, and it does make a difference, doesn't it? All right, thank you all. And thank you, Senator Morse, for asking that question so that we had a chance to honor Ms. Merkel. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2729. Unfortunately, we cannot go to work session because we didn't schedule it for a work session, but it will be back, and we will pop it out just like that, so no fear. All right, thank everyone. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2116, and we're way behind, so let's get cracking.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2116 directs the grants for public library services to be used for early literacy services for children from birth to age 5, and to provide statewide summer reading program for children from birth to age 14. It establishes a minimum grant amount and declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007.
Okay. We only have two folks to sign up. You know, I did better managing this committee with Senate bills. What happened with these House bills?
It's confusing.
Mary Kay Dahlgren and Mary... Oh, I can't get a name. There you go. Two Marys. Good morning.
Good morning. Chairman Walker and members of the committee, my name is Mary Kay Dahlgren. I'm Library Development Program Manager at the Oregon State Library. House Bill 2116 was introduced by Governor Kulongoski at the request of the Oregon State Library Board of Trustees. The purpose of the bill is to allow public libraries to have even more impact on children and families being ready to learn to read and to love to read. And the way that House Bill 2116 would achieve that is focus on early literacy activities for children ages 0 to 5 and a statewide summer reading program for children ages 0 to 14. And evidence is showing us that the ability of public libraries to address these two community needs is great, and we can have an impact on the efforts, we can have an impact on children and their families with those two programs in public libraries. The minimum grants of $1,000 for these ready-to-read grants allow all of the public libraries to focus on these two important areas and to have sufficient funds to offer evidence-based practices effectively. And just to bring it down to the local level, if this bill is passed, Estacada Public Library would have gotten $420 in their ready-to-read grant, and then if the bill passes, they would receive $1,000. The Powers Public Library would receive $103 under the old program and would receive $1,000 under the new program. This bill was put together because of investigation and planning by the statewide Early Literacy Planning Initiative, which included the entire Oregon library community. It was led by Multnomah County Library with federal funds. We had community meetings across the state. We included a variety of people who were involved in early childhood. And that initiative recommended to the Oregon State Library Board of Trustees the narrowing of focus to statewide summer reading program and early literacy activities, and the restoration of the funding to $1 per child. The governor's budget has included the restoration of the funding to $1 per child and the $1,000 minimum grants. That budget has passed both the House and the Senate and is awaiting the governor's signature. It's important to note that the partnership between state funds and local fundings is that in 2005-2006, for each $1 spent on ready-to-read funds, $2.24 were leveraged in local money. On behalf of the Oregon State Library Board of Trustees, I urge your support of House Bill 2116, and I welcome any of your questions.
Fabulous program. And I see in the bill it says the trustees of the state library may not make a grant that is less than $1,000 to a qualifying public library. So that's great. Everybody will get at least $1,000.
Yes, and that will be so nice to be able to provide $1,000 rather than the $60 we have provided in the past to some of our smallest libraries.
Great. Thank you. We'll hear from the other Mary.
Hello. Good morning. Mary Ganane, Youth Services Manager at Eugene Public Library. Honorable Senator Walker and members of the Senate Education and General Government Committee. In my written testimony, I have information about how Eugene Public Library expends its ready-to-read grant. We've received a ready-to-read grant since the program was instituted in 1993. And we do a delivery of incentive bags, which I have samples of here, done by a half-time staff person and volunteers to parents of new parents of babies, and also in group settings, delivering the message of how important reading to babies and starting young is in the development of early literacy skills. We had formerly used our ready-to-read program grant money for two other programs having to do with family daycare centers and a partnership with Head Start. We still do those programs, but now we fund those out of our library budget, and so the ready-to-read money has acted as seed money for us to then take over some other programs. The important part, I think, of my testimony, given the changes that are proposed in the bill, is that the Eugene Public Library and Oregon Library Association do support the changes for dedicating the money to early literacy and summer reading programs. These are proven, evidence-based programs that help in developing lifelong readers and leaders. What a child knows about reading before they enter school, which are what is called the early literacy skills, is a predictor of future reading success. And the things that libraries do with ready-to-read money to encourage early literacy are also proven. Research also shows that reading just 4 to 6 books in the summer helps kids retain their reading levels that they had when they left school in June. And so, again, that those efforts by libraries in summer reading programs are having results that are important for the future of the kids. Libraries also communicate with parents and caregivers in both early literacy and summer reading programs so that families become our partners in growing these future readers. Minimum grants for the smaller libraries also make sense in assisting them with resources to offer effective early literacy and summer reading programs. So I just would encourage you to support House Bill 2116. Thank you.
Thank you. I didn't know you had this Storytime Express.
Yes.
That's pretty cool, getting books out to daycare providers in the community.
Correct. And also modeling for the providers how to integrate literature-based activities with the children. And we like to view it as a you know, that role modeling jumpstarts the provider to doing it on their own.
Yeah, it's, I know it is valuable to teach kids to read early. Both my kids did, and at Christmas they always get books and some musical thing because I thought that was important. And they look forward to every Christmas because they know they're getting lots of books, but they get them throughout the year because it's really important. I think the more we read, the better we write and communicate, and the more we learn, of course.
It all goes together.
Any questions from the committee? I think we like this bill. Okay, ladies, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2116 and open a work session.
Madam Chair, excuse me. I move House Bill 2116 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2116 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Okay, Madam Chair, just briefly, my wife's on the local library board, and so I understand the importance of this, but I'd also point out that this program is not going to be much help to some county libraries if the county libraries have to close down. So just another plug for the safety net dollars and our being aware of the potential impacts on our rural counties.
And I'm glad you pointed that out because there are some libraries, I believe, in Medford.
Josephine County.
County, who shut down and the children were sitting on the steps in front of a closed library. That was a sad photo.
Madam Chair, my wife is co-chair of their attempt to try to come up with additional funds to keep the library in Douglas County open as well.
Good. Thank you. Any other discussion? All right, Ms. Gravel, we haven't heard from you today.
Hi.
Senator Morris.
Hi.
Hi.
Vice
Chancellor. Hi. Hi. House Bill 2116 is on its way to the Senate. Thank you all. Senator Cruz, since your wife is on a library board, would you like to carry that?
I'd love to. Thank you.
Okay, we are going to move right along. Open a public hearing, or close a work session on 2116. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2208.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2208 entitles the Qualifying Veteran Pursuing Study or Training Part-Time to State Financial Aid, provides an aid at a specified rate for a specified period of time, declares an emergency and take effect upon passage. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means as well as the -1 Amendment that I will describe briefly.
Okay.
The -1 Amendment increases the amount of monthly aid to veterans enrolled full-time to $150. Currently, it's $150. And it increases the amount in the bill of the monthly aid to veterans enrolled part-time to $200. The original bill has $100.
Okay, thank you. Can I hear from Val Conley, Mac McDonald, and General Caldwell? That's a referral to Ways and Means.
Which is strange.
Yeah, because it looks to me like it's only $54,000.
Oh, with the amendment, it would be over
$100,000.
Oh. Oh,
Okay. Do you want more money? You know, we could have taken this out of the referral, but okay.
Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Val Conley. I am the Administrator of Veterans Services Division for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I don't know where the Dash 1 amendment came from.
I don't either.
No, we just found out about it. I know it's not in the governor's recommended budget.
Really?
Yes.
And your administrator has to plead
ignorance.
Total loss of memory. It came to me like 6 weeks ago, and I don't recall who brought it to my attention.
Well, what's your position on the Dash 1 amendment? Do you
have one? Well, I don't have a position. All I can state is that it's not in the governor's recommended budget.
Oh, well, of course. I forgot. That's the standard response. You could just put the push the robot button and
exactly.
Get that answer.
Exactly. I've got other people here who can.
All right. Well, we'll let other people, the other kids, talk about this.
A little bit of history on the state educational aid program, and I
okay.
will be very brief, is yeah. that this program was established shortly after the conclusion of World War II at the rate of $50 for full-time enrollment and $35 for part-time enrollment. In the last legislative session, these amounts increased from $50 to $150 for full-time enrollment. Somehow, the provision for part-time students dropped off. So I think we only had about a dozen people enrolled in part-time, and they were no longer eligible for the program. So what this bill will do is it will add back an entitlement for part-time veteran students at the rate of $100 per month.
Okay.
No, $100 for part-time enrollment.
What's in the bill currently?
Right.
Correct.
And then someone with the Dash 1 wanted to bump it up to $200.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the full-time.
Madam Chair, my name is Matt McDonald.
Yeah.
United Veterans Army. We support the bill, and I also support the amendment, having worked my way through college. I want to point out that after World War II in Korea, most of our servicemen that came back were single. Today, most of them are married, and the reason they're in part-time education is because they're married with family, and they really have to work. And many of them work, do part-time one semester and maybe even skip the next semester because of funds and because of family responsibilities. So we support the bill, and I don't know who came in with the amendment, but I'd support the amendment too, because money really is tight for young families just starting out. And these people are putting forth an effort to get a better education for a better life. So I'd support not only the bill, but the amendment.
Okay. General Caldwell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Military Department, and I think Mr. McDonald said it very well. As we discussed earlier, costs of education are extremely high. This is a pittance when it comes to that, and I think anything we can do to help these young men and women after they return from their service to get a better education is in our best interest and good public policy for this state. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. And I read somewhere when I was reviewing this bill that this doesn't impact too many. 27 part-time students is what we're looking at in the fiscal.
Yeah, Chair Walker, that is correct.
Okay. All right, any questions from the committee?
Yeah. Okay. I have one for General Caldwell. This is just a process question. We have this bill. It's designed to extend aid to part-time folks to give them some help out. Obviously, the committee is going to be very supportive of that, and the body would be very supportive of that. We have the amendment, which will send this bill to Ways and Means, and don't know what will happen there. Just that's because you know the Ways and Means process. So I'm just asking you, I mean, we can pass this bill, I think, certainly the way it is, and rescind the Ways and Means, and it's done. Or we can send it down there, and, I mean, and then there's just that risk of all the other stuff. And I actually don't have a preference. I'm happy to do either one, but I also know what kind of generally happens when that happens, and I just want to know if you have a thought on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger,
can I take your guidance?
I think Ms. Connolly said it probably best. I think this bill was originally intended to fix what didn't get done in the last session, which was to add back the part-time students. And it only took care of the full-time students, which is not a lot of folks. So that was the original intent of the bill. I think the additional monies being added to it would seem to me that it would be a good thing to do because of the, you know, the small amount that we're talking here. I mean, you're not going to buy a tuition with this kind of money.
Sure.
You might buy some books. You may get some cab fare, bus fare. Might help you out just a little bit to get you to where you need to be. Certainly not going to make or break any student if you want to go to school. So I don't know how to particularly answer your question. I think that I would hope that it goes through the Ways and Means process, and I'm looking to the right of the table, and I know that Senator Walker and Senator Westland and Senator Morris all sit on the Ways and Means Committee. I would hope that they would, you know, push that thing through because it is a pittance. On the other hand, you know, it's kind of like the old adage, you know, we set out to drain the swamp and we find ourselves up to our neck in alligators. So I think you could go either way on it, frankly.
Okay.
And the few number that are going to take that part-time, and you know, when we're seeing from our folks, a good number of them are going to the community college doing it part-time simply because, in our case, in the Guard's case, and reservists as well, as they're older. They have families, and they can't go to school full-time. So part-time students is kind of about 70% of the folks that we have engaged in college activities, and there's around 500 right now in the American Guard, and 500-600. 70% of those folks are community college folks. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's a good question.
I'm happy to do either one.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. When you look at the fiscal analysis, it's based on the original bill. And I question how this got here from the House, because it does, even with the original bill, it raises, it's above the $50,000 threshold that's supposed to go to Ways and Means. But with the dash one, it's indeterminate at this point. I mean, I can do the math on the part-time students, and it goes to 108, but I'm not sure the impact of the of going to 250 on the full-time students would be, because we don't have any analysis of that in here.
No, we don't. Senator Westland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Senator Metzger's question, because I was having exactly the same assignations, and I don't want to put words in the general's mouth, but as he was responding, what I was coming to the conclusion of is, you know, in terms of the impact of this bill, I think the risk-reward ratio is in place to, granted, expose it to possibly no action whatsoever, but passing it has, out of Ways and Means, has a much greater and more meaningful impact to some of our returning guardsmen. So I don't know if that's, you know, an appropriate characterization of your remarks. Like I say, that's just my one man's impression of where I think we are. So it's probably the right thing to do, and we do have, you know, several Ways and Means member on this committee that I know. Yeah. And I think I can speak for Senator Morris will be advocating, and Senator Walker will be.
Yeah, it'll come to my head, sub.
Okay.
So we can babysit and take care of it quite nicely. Okay, Senator Morris and I. So thanks for the question, Senator Metzger. I'm glad we had the conversation. All right. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2208. Open a work session. Senator Cruz.
You want the ones?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good. Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2208.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2208. Any further discussion? No objections, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2208 as amended to the full Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2208 as amended to the full Committee on Ways and Means from a prior reference. Any discussion? Okay.
With a due pass.
With a due pass. Thank you. I love having you on my left. All right. Well, Ms. Gravel, I'm not going to have you take the role on that. There's no objection, so ordered. It's on its way. I'll take care of it when it gets down there.
Okay, next we are, okay, we're going to skip ahead because the superintendent is here. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2263.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2263A abolishes the Certificate of Initial Mastery and Certificate of Advanced Mastery, modifies the Early Childhood Improvement Program, and eliminates learning centers, the Oregon 21st Century Schools Program, the School Improvement and Professional Development Program, and the Statewide Literacy Hotline, permits school districts to establish child development specialist programs, declares an emergency, and will take effect July 1st, 2007.
Okay, thank you. Superintendent, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Castillo, Oregon Superintendent of Public Instruction. I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 2263, which would abolish the statutory references to the Certificate of Initial Mastery and the Certificate of Advanced Mastery. And to make very clear, the certificates themselves would be abolished, and academic standards and assessments would remain. It's time to move, in my opinion, it is time to move beyond SIM and CAM. I'm not talking about abandoning what these certificates have been about, which is high standards and strong accountability for student performance and creating a relevant learning experience that connects students with the workplace and the community. This does not take a step backward or lower standards and expectations. Assessment of our state standards will continue. But I do believe that the time has come to turn the page on SIM and CAM. As Oregonians, we can't be anchored to acronyms that no longer fit our future. Before we get into the merits of the bill, I just wanted to take a moment to recognize all of the school districts and educators, particularly in districts like North Clackamas, which have embraced SIM and CAM and helped create nationally recognized educational experiences for their students. We'll be looking to their good work to guide us as we move forward on implementing the new high school diploma requirements. In 1991, the Oregon Legislature enacted the 21st Century Schools Act in response to strong evidence that our schools were producing students without the skills needed to succeed in the workplace or college, and the SIM and CAM are parts of this visionary education reform bill passed under the leadership of Norma Paulus and Vera Katz that included state academic standards, rigorous tests for all students, more early childhood education, a longer school year, and professional technical education for high school students. And once a student mastered these high standards, they would earn these two certificates in addition to the high school diploma. But from the beginning, the road to SIM and CAM has been bumpy and full of unexpected twists and turns. In response to criticisms and concerns, the Act was rewritten in 1995, and among the changes then were student portfolios were made optional and pilot programs were allowed, delays in implementation of the SIM-CAM certificates were granted and allowed, provisions requiring a second language were delayed, provisions requiring the full funding of pre-kindergarten were delayed, and we had the addition of rigorous academic content standards and criteria reference tests. Well, if we fast forward to this year, and the legacy of SIM-CAM continues to look bleak, funding for full implementation of SIM-CAM has never been provided by the legislature. After 16 years on the books, only about a third of students earn the SIM each year. No colleges, even our state schools, ask students about the SIM. Few, if any, businesses and employers ask applicants if they've earned a SIM, and the CAM has been postponed repeatedly and is still completely voluntary for our schools. I've heard from educators that the certificate system has been too complex and confusing, that it was delivered from the top down with little input from schools. And while some schools have embraced SIM and CAM, our most recent data shows that only 31% of our students earned a SIM in 2006, and that's down from the all-time high of only 37% of students in 2005. And since the certificates have never been requirements for graduation, that has led many students to ask, why then do they even matter? A not uncommon response that I hear from students as I visit around the state is, if they are so important, how come they aren't required and my employer or college doesn't care if I have one? I think you're all aware that oftentimes when you just mention the acronyms SIM and CAM, you spark controversy.
What was once a great idea to improve the education of our students has been caught in the political back and forth of those that want to fully implement SIM and CAM and make them part of the graduation requirements and those who want to abolish them completely. Well, as the state superintendent, I've looked closely at the SIM and CAM, and the truth lies somewhere in between what the advocates and the opponents say. There are parts of the current system that are excellent and work very well for students, and there are other parts of the current system that are not working as they were envisioned. And that's why I've come to the conclusion that it's now time to learn what we can from SIM and CAM and concentrate on the big picture of what Oregon students need in order to be successful in the 21st century. The world moves fast, and the future demands a different, a more ambitious approach to high school education. The State Board of Education has completed their review of high school graduation requirements and standards, assessments, and the credentials. And beginning with the class of 2010, all our students will be required to meet the first phase of our rigorous standards for our new high school diploma requirements. The new requirements will be fully implemented by 2012. And I firmly believe that the new diploma will deliver a better, more rigorous, more relevant system for student achievement. With a more meaningful high school diploma, our students will be better prepared to move forward. It's about clearly articulating what we want our students to know and be able to do to prepare them for success in college and work or citizenship in this 21st century global economy. And because SIM and CAM have been about reaching high standards of achievement and making learning more relevant, we will hang on to the parts that have been helpful to students. But if we continue our current system of SIM and CAM, we only have high achievement for some students. A more rigorous diploma will mean higher achievement for all students. It continues to be very important that we have clear and measurable standards that tell us if our students are achieving the goals we have established as a state, and that we provide information to parents, to schools, and to districts that help focus on improvement. So my goal in working with the state board, with the legislature, and with the governor is to take everything we've learned, what works and what doesn't, and build a system that works better for everyone and lifts achievement for every Oregon student. House Bill 2263 is an important step along the path towards raising student achievement. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about this bill.
Just one, Superintendent, thank you for coming. It's my understanding there are still a few little details to be worked out and that there will be an amendment coming forward.
That's right, Madam Chair. Those are in the works.
Okay, great. And I know Senator Metzger has a question because North Clackamas is in your district, is it not?
Yes. Yeah, I probably will not be supporting this when we get along. No disrespect for your great work, Superintendent, but because of the great work of my school district to actually meet those standards. I guess this is just a question I have for you. It's I remember back in 99 when we were together in the Senate, and we had a lot of discussions about SIM and in the body, and particularly centered around the cost. And as you recall, there were all these discussions that it was that we were spending hundreds of millions of dollars, I think was kind of the thing, you know, on this program that could otherwise be more effective in the classroom. I did sit on Ways and Means that first year, and I do recall, as I was going through notes on this with the department about the cost of managing the program from the department standpoint. And so there's just one thing that puzzles me about this part. There is no fiscal impact to eliminate this program. I mean, and I was just asking the committee administrator on it, and it says, you know, minimal expenditure impact, revenue impact. And I'm thinking, how could that possibly be after all these years of all the expense that the department, you know, said they had needed to run this program from a department level, and then we hear, of course, from our own schools about the cost of that, and yet eliminating it turns out that, you know, there's no fiscal impact. I mean, how can that be? How can there be no fiscal impact for something that was very expensive to run, but now when we eliminate it, it has no impact? Could you kind of square that with me a little
absolutely,
bit?
Absolutely, Madam Chair and Senator Metzger. I think your question is an absolutely perfect example of the confusion that has surrounded SIM-CAM from when we created it, when we've been trying to implement it, and now that we're trying to move on. Sim and Cam were about creating standards in our state and aligning our instruction to help our students reach those standards, and then creating a testing system or assessment system on how we measure that. Well, we're not going to stop doing that, and that is what the cost of Sim and Cam have been. Oh, and then the other part of the was helping our students have a more relevant learning experience and helping them, have extended learning experiences, which we will still continue to do because that is good best practices work, and we want our students to still continue to do that. So what we're talking about, I know that it's confusing. What we're doing is we're eliminating the certificates, not the basic structures of what all of that great work is about. And that's why it doesn't have a fiscal impact, because we will continue to have our standards, we will continue to test, we will continue to have a instruction that tries to help our students get to those high standards. Only what we're trying to accomplish with the elimination of the certificates is the confusion that exists around that, and that we refocus our attention on the high school diploma, which everyone understands what that is, and we really help all of our students meet a higher level of rigor and accomplishment with the new high school diploma. So we're not backing off of so many of the things that have been the cost drivers with Sim and Cam, because we're still going to have high standards, we're still going to have our testing, we're still going to have reporting of how our students are doing and tracking their progress. In fact, we want to do a better job of that and really continue to evolve how it is we track our students and do a better job of their performance. And so that's why really there isn't, and I don't know, I have my chief policy officer here if you want to add to that, but I think that's basically the reason why there isn't a significant difference in the cost of what we're doing today.
Chair Walker, I'm Pat Burke. I'm the chief policy officer at the department. Just to add to what the superintendent said, current statute makes the certificates of initial and advanced mastery something that are awarded by school districts, not the state. So the cost, if you will, and Senator Metzger, the issue of North Clackamas is a very good one. Many of our districts have invested in preparing programs related to the certificates. So just to take North Clackamas as an example, instead of thinking of this as some kind of termination of the work that North Clackamas has done, I prefer to think of this in the opposite way. Mm-hmm. North Clackamas will show the way as a lead district in how these fundamental standards, as the superintendent just described, are applied to all kids. That's what North Clackamas did. They took it to scale, took it to all students. That work under the current proposal is not only still valid, it is the kind of work that all districts will be needing to do, because the diploma applies to all kids. The certificates were voluntary. Mm-hmm. So North Clackamas is now, in my view, in an excellent position to move the new diploma into full operation. But the cost, as the superintendent described, is to the agency, the costs are in the standards and assessment, the data collection and reporting system, and all of that remains in place.
Madam Chair, I won't belabor the point, and I do appreciate the comments, but it is just a very confusing thing, and as you go through the bill and some of the eliminations about the reports, the waivers that can be requested on various things with the certificates, and because on the converse side of this, as we've had even this session with different proposals, and we have had some I would consider pretty vanilla requests in some bills for the Department of Education, like to report how many kids are taking PE, and the first thing we hear is, well, we need a and I think that one was a we need a full-time FTE just to take a report from a school district on how many people are taking PE, but we eliminate all these other reports and things, and there's no impact. It just has sometimes it's difficult to to kind of fathom. I understand what you're saying about the certificates, but there's so much in here about reporting and requests and waivers, and they're now being eliminated, and someone had to manage that. But it was a big cost to do it, and there's no big cost to eliminate it. It's just confusing. But I do appreciate your explanation.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, if I could just add, and members of the committee, as we move forward with the implementation of the new high school diploma requirements, we're going to be coming back to you with the need for some very targeted investments to help us get all of our students to this higher level of rigor. And so right now we're putting together and getting off the ground a statewide implementation effort that will involve people across the state on helping us understand and helping us cost out and really do some good analysis of what is it going to take to get all of our students to higher levels of achievement in math and science, and, you know, how do we make better progress for all of our students in these areas. And so we will be coming back to you with a report and some requests for that as well. So we're not retreating from any of this good work. It's really about moving forward and helping all of our students. It's about every single student and helping them get to the high levels of achievement that we want them to get to.
Thank you.
We appreciate all that explanation, but I share Senator Metzger's frustration. Teachers and districts are so frustrated by the legislature always changing the rules of the game, and it was a huge financial investment that blew up in our face, because I don't think we did a very good job of marketing the SIM and the CAM to employers or to the university system or the community college system. And I attempted to address that last session, spent a lot of time on what I could do, but determined it was actually too late to make that investment at this point. It should have been done a long time ago. And people forget about the marketing aspect of what we do here. We can make all the laws we want, but if we don't market it correctly, it doesn't mean a hill of beans to anybody. So I'm pretty frustrated myself, but I sort of resigned to the fact that we're going to start something new. And Senator Cruz has his comments.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And personally, I'm not resigned to anything at this point, but I have issues, and I'm going to need to spend some more time on this. I mean, we're eliminating the buzzwords that people attack. I think many other things are still in place. And as you know, Madam Chair, I have issues potentially with new graduation requirements, and I'm hoping we have the ability to spend some time on that issue specifically. But additionally, when I'm looking at Section 17 through 22 of the bill and the nexus between that and House Bill 2848, because they're kind of referencing the same sort of issue with special needs students, and Dana said there was another bill also that was dealing in the same subject area. Clearly, one way to deal with this would be to go ahead and pass everything and let LC sort it out. Madam Chair, I would prefer that we kind of take a look at those issues as a body and make sure that whatever policy we're writing is appropriate, so we aren't ending up just trying to do conflict amendments, because I have always had issues with us passing off that responsibility.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. What I think I'll do is some of the folks came into my office yesterday and met with me. I'm going to send them in to see you as well to get your input. Okay, any other questions? Thank you both. I appreciate you coming down. We just have one other person to testify, Mr. Wilner, Robert Wilner. We will be going to 10:15 today, colleagues, because we have to finish these other two bills. I'm sorry. The Aspire program aspired a little bit too long.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity.
Good to see you again, Mr. Wilner.
I'm Bob Wilner, Executive Director of the Oregon International Council. Came to Oregon to work for the Oregon Governor's Commission on Foreign Language and International Studies, and retired, been engaged since then in trying to promote the efforts of that committee to help prepare our students to function in this international dimension in which we all live. And I think standards of education are extremely important for that, especially with regard to the Mr. Joe average. That, I think, is where our problem has lain. Our outstanding students are outstanding, and there are some others who need, who are never really going to be functional. The real concern, though, as I say, is Joe average. And if I may offer one anecdote from the family, my father was an accidental observer of the Russian Revolution as an Austrian war prisoner from 1914 to 1920. And I grew up on a lot of stories. And he got to know a number of Russians quite well and admired them. And I asked him once, if there was so much talent and capability, why did it end up so badly? And in response to the key, he said, the peaks were always as high as anywhere. The problem was that the average was so low. Most Russians could not read, had no idea of the world they lived in. When things fell apart, they were desperate for anybody who'd come to them with a plan, and that was Lenin and his Bolshevik party. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's our danger, but we face a very complex situation in the coming generations, and our kids have to be aware of that, and they have to be educated to deal with it. And I am concerned that doing away with SIM and CAN may, as has been suggested, be perceived as doing away with standards. And I don't think we can allow that to happen. It could be very devastating. I'm also concerned with one specific part of this bill that appears to create a pretty wide exception, Section 329.451.3. Notwithstanding subsection 2 of this section, a school district may award a diploma to a student who does not satisfy the requirements of the section if the student has met or exceeded the academic content standards for mathematics or English established by the board, or displays proficiency in mathematics or English at a level established by the board. I read that as meaning all you have to do is meet one of those standards and you get your diploma. That may not be the intention, but I think there's a danger that it'll be read that way. And I hope that some expert can read this over and determine whether there is such a danger. My overall concern is, however, that this bill emphasizing abolition of the standards in the public eye will be taken by a lot of students as meaning the heat's off, we can go back to the D-average diploma. And I think that would be contrary to the interests of the state and the nation. I thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Wilner, and thank you for not reading your testimony, because we have it and we can read it,
right.
And I appreciated listening to you. Your comment about Section 20 goes to exactly what Senator Cruz was concerned about.
Yes.
All right, thank you very much, sir. We are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2263A. This will come back at a later date. I will now go and open a public hearing on House Bill 3414.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3414 allows residents from an adjoining county to be appointed by a county court to serve as a county fair board member. There's a dash one before us that has an emergency clause that would make it effective upon passage.
Okay, this must be because of a problem with one county fair board district. Thank you. We have three people signed up to testify, Leslie Lewis, Kara Fisher, and John McCulley. Please all come up. And you're all in support. And if you don't read your testimony, that'd be fabulous.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Leslie Lewis, County Commissioner from Yamhill County. And you said this is probably a problem for one specific county, and I guess that would be Yamhill County. We have a very valuable fair board member. We have a five-member fair board, and two of them have been appointed within the last year. So we have about half and half, experienced and inexperienced. One of our very experienced fair board members has been with us since 2001. She and her husband moved to Polk County, the next county over. So when she comes
you
up for
with
a week.
Pardon? She went with him when
yes, she did. They both still work in Yamhill County. She's a financial controller for Western Oregon Waste, one of our major employers in Yamhill County. And as part of her job responsibility, she's supposed to do community service in Yamhill County. And this is the community service that she does. Her child still continues to attend school in Yamhill County. Her husband works at Cascade Steel in Yamhill County. We have 4-H'ers who come from other counties to show at our fair, so youth are allowed to do it. We just really want to be able to reappoint her this July when she comes up for reappointment, and that is why we have the emergency clause. You have a letter from our board unanimously supporting House Bill 3414 and the emergency clause. You also have a letter from the other 4 fair board members unanimously supporting House Bill 3414 with the amendment. And, Madam Chair, I would answer any questions that you have.
Well, it just occurred to me, I wanted to call you Representative Lewis, I do appreciate your service here in the legislature, but it just occurred to me, what if one of us moved outside of our district? Would we just come and pass a law that says we can run for office because we suddenly moved with our spouse of a neighboring county, neighboring district? I mean, you could take that to that extent.
Well, I understand that, but that's, Madam Chair, I understand your concern about that, but I think when you're talking about an elected official versus an appointed position, I do think you're talking about something different, because the elected officials represent a certain number of electors in their district. Serving on a fair board is not exactly a representative type of position. It does require a tremendous number of volunteer hours. It requires people with a variety of skills. In our case, Wendy Crawford, who's currently the chair of our fair board, is, because of her finance background, has helped our fair through some very difficult times. As you'll see in my letter, we were at one time $50,000 in debt. We've been in the black for the last 6 fiscal years. And we will actually, I'm not just talking about the fair, I'm talking about the fair and the year-round event center. We will end this fiscal year with about $70,000 in the black. And I do attribute a lot of that to her. She's our finance expert on the board, and that would be a difficult position to replace for us, to find that expertise and to find someone who wanted to put in the hours. Obviously, there's folks who have that expertise, but they might not want to use it on a fair board.
Okay. I just needed to throw that question out there. Mr. McCauley, I want to hear from you, because you represent the Oregon Fairs Association. As you know, my county no longer has a fair board. The commissioners just booted them.
They have an unfair board?
It doesn't have one at all. So, we just dissolved our fair board, honey.
Madam Chair, members mm-hmm. of the committee, I'm John McCauley, representing the Oregon Fairs Association. We are the statewide organization of the county fairs in the state. We do support House Bill 3414. We do believe that it would be used very rarely, but at the same time, it does provide flexibility to county commissioners when they face these very unique circumstances, as you've heard here. So we believe that it is in the best interest of the fairs in the state to have county commissioners have the flexibility to appoint the best people to the fair board, no matter where they may come from. In our opinion, 99.999% of the time, those will be residents of the county. But there may be that rare circumstance where that won't be the case, and we believe the commission should have the ability to go outside the county if absolutely necessary.
Okay. Question from Senator Wessel.
Well, just a comment, Madam Chair. First of all, I think this is a very good bill. And so many of the dynamics, not only in specific counties, but between different counties, you know, are so unique. I mean, my county, very much like yours, you know, the commissioners are assuming a greater and greater function of a, you know, vibrant, fast-growing area of that fair that represents that growth. But, you know, just
Crook County and Wheeler County and John Day and Jefferson County. I mean, there's a great deal of interface and interaction between those fairs, and there's, you know, pretty much a growing dependency on each fair for each other, but there's a great deal of collaboration between our more rural counties, and I can absolutely see where there is, you know, a good reason for this bill, and it is permissive in terms of May. So I very much appreciate everyone bringing this issue forward, and I do think it will have a positive and beneficial impact for our county fairs, particularly in smaller, more rural counties.
Okay. Any other questions? We need to hear from our other guests. Ms. Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Kara Fisher with the Association of Oregon Counties. You have my testimony, so I'll move very quickly in the interest of your time. Other counties join Yamhill County in desiring this change in statute. As has been pointed out, the Fair Board positions are voluntary. They require a hefty workload. When you accept that position, you are taking on quite a responsibility both for making the county fair happen and the fiscal responsibility. Other counties have run into conflict trying to find people, qualified people who have the time and the interest to serve on their fair boards. In addition to the examples that Commissioner Lewis gave you, I would share one other example, that counties that happen to have tribal lands on their county, they've wanted to appoint a tribal member to their fair board, mm-hmm. only to discover that while that tribal member lives on tribal land, he or she lives over a county line. So that has been the other area of conflict. So AOC would ask you to move the bill to the floor with the dash one amendment, and we appreciate you hearing the bill today. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Fisher.
That was a very good point.
Right. That sort of was the one that sent me over the line that said, okay.
Thank you.
So thank you for your testimony. All right. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3414. I'll open a work session.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 3414.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 3414. Any discussion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3414 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3414 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Senator Metzger.
I think this bill will open up the opportunity for all the folks in Lane County to now have, once again, have an opportunity to be on a fair board, since they don't have their own, but maybe they could be on the Douglas County Fair Board, and extend the opportunity to other Oregonians. And I think we should be inclusive, and it's a good bill.
Thank you. I had not thought about that. You know, I had once applied to be on the Lane County Fair Board, but the commissioners didn't even entertain my application because I had picketed the fair board for what I thought were some bad decisions they had made to remove some of the local vendors who were making, local community groups who were making money at the food booths. And so I picketed for several days with some of the Vietnam veterans and some of the other local groups, and they just didn't think that
it's
I would
not
be
a good campaign strategy.
No, it wasn't. So I moved on to other offices.
Madam Chair, this is a good bill. My father was on the Douglas County Fair Board forever, I think, and they do work hard, and it is valuable service. I'm sorry to see that Lane County's gone a different direction, and I don't know the issues there. But I'd also want to take this chance to say hi to my good friend Leslie, and we miss you. But you have an actual job that pays real money now, as opposed to us.
You know,
I'd be here were it not for term.
I know that.
There are a number of retired, quote unquote, retired legislators serving on the county commission, so I think they are blessed with all of our knowledge and our ability to get things done. Okay, hearing nothing else, Ms. Gravel, call the roll, please.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator
Moore?
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 3414 will pass. And Senator Westland, I'm going to have you carry that since you decided it was such a good idea. All right, we're going to open a public hearing on HJM 5. We can punch this out in 10 minutes and be done.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Joint Memorial 5 urges Congress to extend the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000 through the federal fiscal year 2016 and to fund the act with a mandatory continuing appropriation. For your reference and interest, the House at the federal level did pass the bill extending the act for 1 year. The Senate passed a version extending the act for 5 years. The House version carried forward in the war funding bill that was vetoed yesterday. And I know there are members signed up to testify who can take it from there if there is anything to say beyond that at this time.
Hopefully.
Okay, great. David Mormon, Dave Barrows, and Gil Riddell. And we are being a letter from Josh Carden is being distributed, and Mayor Potter. Mr. Barrows, you're at the table first, so start.
Yes, ma'am.
You would please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Barrows. I represent the Association of O&C Counties. It's been my great privilege to represent that organization for more than 40 years. As the members of the committee, I think, know, the O&C counties are all contained in Oregon. They are essentially all the west side counties, except Clatsop, which is not an O&C county, plus Klamath, which is. They get receipts primarily from the Bureau of Land Management. They get half the money, back in the days when we used to actually cut trees, they get half the money from timber receipts, now an appropriation under the Secure Lands Act. And that money, unlike National Forest money, which Mr. Riddell obviously will talk about, goes into the general fund, not the road fund. And so it is critical money for many counties. Senator Cruz's county will lose 67% of its general fund revenues if this is not renewed. I mean, this is not out at the margin. That's at the heart. So we are in strong support of this bill. We were the ones that kind of pushed it as hard as anybody last session, and we joined with the AOC this time in supporting this. All of you voted for essentially the same memorial last time, and we hope you will do so again this time. And I would also like to just say, if I may, Madam Chair, parenthetically, that it was my great pleasure to represent the Oregon County Fairs Association back in the 70s and early 80s, before I pretty much limited my work to the savings and loans and O&C. And they are a great group of folks, and I remember your father very fondly, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And just a correction on what Mr. Barrow said, because he was referring to Douglas County, but I also represent Jackson, Josephine, Coos, and Curry, so I'm kind of the epicenter here.
Yes,
so.
You are.
Yeah, I wish there was more than we could do than just do a memorial.
Mr. Riddell has some suggestions.
Well, you know, I just don't understand why we aren't doing a class action lawsuit against the federal government with all these states. So, Mr. Riddell, tell me what we're doing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. This is a familiar topic. I want to first point out, before I get to that question, the little packet, familiar to you as well, I hope. The reason why this matters, this matters to you, although it's called county payments often in the media, is that it represents about $60 million for education. That's a direct matter to you, but it also represents, as Dave says, it'll be about $215 million of county general funds per biennium that's not available for payment for shared services.
$215
million of general funds, not to mention the road funds. And if counties cannot step up in these red colored shared services, then the state has to do it. So there's another cost to you.
Mm-hmm.
The third, your administrator talked about the single year appropriation. That's fine, but look what happens after that. You see the black bar, which would represent the single year. We heard from Senator Wyden's office yesterday that there's a clear and present danger that not only will we not get this 1 year, because of the machinations of the bigger issue, the global issue of the war. The issue of the five-year, the Wyden Plan proposal, which is we've got the votes in the Senate. The issue in the House is that the chair of the Appropriations Committee, David Obey from Wisconsin, is uncomfortable with having a policy matter in a supplemental bill. So our strategy at this point, as Dave mentioned, it's not only a coalition within the state, it's a nationwide coalition. Participation from the education community and others. We're trying through contacts to encourage the Speaker Pelosi, to visit with David Obey and encourage him to go ahead and let the 5-year come into the supplemental bill. There are offsets that exist for that 5-year plan. We're ready to go with it. If we don't get it this time, then those offsets will likely go somewhere else, and we have the offsets issue again, the pay-as-you-go issue in the federal budget. The other thing that's important about the 5-year plan is it gives the O&C counties an opportunity to gain support of their far-sighted proposal, which I believe you are all familiar with, and we can make you familiar with if need be. We need some time to get that support developed. So the... Madam Chair, the other thing I would mention is, in terms of the loss, you have a simplified table there on the next sheet that I'm sure you're familiar with. Just to point out, and not to minimize the loss to Multnomah and Washington counties, but if you remove their general fund loss, the loss statewide is actually, of general fund revenues to counties, is 20%. Now, I contrast that with your situation in 2003, when you had a, quote, catastrophic, unquote, loss of general fund revenue of 13%. This is 20%. And again, road funds, $90 million, $91 million a year. So it's hard for us to be full partners in the transportation system if we don't have those funds. Now, counties are doing whatever they can to help themselves. As Senator Cruz knows, there are a couple of counties that are taking ballot measures out. And we had this wonderful tour of the counties, and it made a great impression on those who attended. But we have limited ability to do anything about this because we have very little private land in Oregon. So if the federal government is not a full partner, then we have some pretty serious difficulties adjusting to this. So,
thank you, Mr. Riddell. Yep. We only have about 2 minutes, and then we have to go because we have to be on the floor. Mr. Cluding wanted to testify. Yes, Senator Weston.
Thank you, and I'll be quick here. Just a small correction to Mr. Riddell's comment. We lost 22% of our revenue, very similar to the 20% projected, and we bubblegummed and band-aided and, you know, shifted our way through down to only making 13% cuts. I'd also like to thank Mr. Riddell. Through his considerable work, I was able to get through the National Conference of State Legislatures, NCSL's Executive Committee, a resolution to Congress, and I believe that was in 03, whatever the year was. I think that's about right, maybe 04, and that obviously did not fall on as receptive ears as we all needed. But this is a critical, critical, critical issue to a state with such considerable percentage of our overall lands in public ownership. And I just very much thank you for your, you know, continuing and very capable work on this issue. Thank you, Gil.
Madam Chair, I'd like to point out, following up on Senator Westland, that counties don't have the supply of bubble gum that the state does.
Good point. Mr. Mormon, we're out of time.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, David Mormon, just the Department of Forestry, just wanted to express State Forester Marvin Browns and the department's strong support for this memorial. Our written testimony highlights, again, the importance of extending this program. And also, I think the key point I just want to make is that the department believes that reauthorization and extension of this law is at best a temporary solution, and our written testimony talks about a lot of other things that we need to do in the longer term to correct this issue, and our feeling is that the United States continues to postpone a long overdue clarification by Congress on what the purpose of these federal lands are, and to make that clear on what the contribution of those lands are to our environmental, economic, and social sustainability. Again, our written testimony talks about some detailed longer-term strategies we're working on. Would be happy to talk to you at some future time about that.
Okay, we'll take a look at your written testimony. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Kooting, we're out of time. Do you disagree? Come on, 30 seconds. You have to do it. Keep it to 30. State your name.
Thank you. For the record, Bill Kooting, Carpenters Industrial Council. Three-fourths of my membership disappeared because of this issue. The point I'm going to bring up, Chair Walker, committee, you were right. It's time to quit this game that we're playing. It's time to file a class action lawsuit. As I speak, 180-some representatives on the Far East Coast want hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of more of our acres put in the wilderness. They say it's their land. I say it's our land. It's time for the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kooting.
I absolutely agree.
I'm going to talk to our Attorney General and ask why we haven't done that yet, whether it's a class action or we do it on our own. That'll take years to go through the courts, but at least we can do something proactive. So I will close the public hearing on HJM 5, open a work session.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 5 to the Senate floor with a recommendation that it be adopted.
Senator Cruz moves HJM 5 to the floor of the Senate with a recommendation that it be adopted. Any further discussion? We've had some good discussion, and I will follow up with the Attorney General. Take the roll, please.
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator
Weston? Aye.
Vice
Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. HJM 5 is on its way to the Senate floor, and I will carry that. Okay, at your dais, at your desk here, is the final letter I sent off that you all signed. So you have the fully signed copy on Senate Bill 1029. Have a great weekend, everyone. Thank you for your work. See you on Tuesday. We're adjourned.